speaker tonight is Courtney.
Good evening. My name is Courtney and I'm an alcoholic. I just want to share the gratitude for the invitation to be here. If you're an alcoholic like me, getting invited places is always a treat, and never the novelty of such doesn't seem to wear off. So I'm a sober and active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My sobriety date's July 20th of 2007. I have a sponsor. That person knows that they're my sponsor. And I call that person at least once a week at the same time every week. And lately my call time has been cut short. And so I have to really get to the problem and defend my position in the space of 9 minutes. And on the mornings where I can't quite prove that I'm certainly right and my wife is certainly wrong, he does return my phone call and gives me the long and the short of it, which is that I'm wrong and my wife is most certainly probably right. So all I mean about that is that in the beginning, it was told to me that the things that would be required for me to stay sober and Alcoholics Anonymous was that I was going to have to be honest, I was going to have to be open-minded, and I was going to have to be willing. And as I stay sober day after day with the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, boiling it down to those three things has been really paramount to me being able to make it one more day. Because I think that what we have in alcoholism is a disease of moments. And in any moment, I can make or break that sobriety. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was out of hope. I had been out of hope for a really long time. For me, Alcoholics Anonymous was absolutely the last house on the block. If there was a better way, if there was a different way, if there was a way that had any sort of, that looked like it could work, I either tried it or would have thrown myself at it. And so when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, the thing that I got was hope. But when I also came in, I was certain of a few things. I was certain that I was a liar. I was certain that I was a thief. I was certain that I had squandered a lot of opportunities and wasted a lot of hard-earned money of my family's. I had burned relationships. I had done things that I promised I wasn't going to do time and time again. My word meant nothing. And those things felt like real problems because I had evidence that those things were real problems. But when I got here, the message that was given to me was, what we're going to do is we're going to find out if what you have is alcoholism. And if what you have is alcoholism, we're going to be able to treat that. And what I found in treating those things was that I have a relationship with booze in which I am powerless over alcohol, which means my relationship with booze looked like me stepping into the ring for a fight. I knew I was going to lose. And no matter what, I couldn't get myself to not enter into that ring. And so I was beaten, and I was definitely losing that fight. And it's the first of many paradoxes in our program, right? Is that me just admitting that I certainly can't win was this opening where just a crack of the hope inside of AA came to light. And so when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a really unlovely creature. I had a little bit of a difficult personality. I definitely had a hygiene problem, and I was certain that I was no fun to be around. And in my first meeting of AA, there were two guys there called the Bobs, and they did a lot of things right. And one of the things that they did is they gave me a big book. The other thing that they did is they said, there's a woman, you should go talk to her. And when I did, what I found was a message that had depth and weight. So they didn't pat me on the back, and they didn't say, keep coming back. They said, you need to come back. You need to come back tomorrow. Here's where you need to go. Do you need a ride? Of course, I said I didn't need a ride because I'm difficult to help, right? Like, my story is like, I'm Courtney and I'm angry and I'm hard to help, right? These are the themes of my recovery, right? So for anyone who's new, when we tell you it gets better, it's not like we're lying. It really does. But my experience, it isn't quite like this like glory story of spiritual progress and growth, right? It does get better, I promise you that. But what it feels like is that I fall down and I get back up with help. And I fall down and I get back up with help. And so really my life in recovery is like kind of like this long process of elimination of like how not to live my life, right? I went from being a good on paper kid, somebody that you know, my parents were proud of, somebody that was like a neighborhood, you know, people wanted to see me, they waved. I went from being that kid to like just a distant memory of that. I was like a young daily maintenance drinker, which means I only rolled out of bed for booze. And I continued to drink throughout the day, no matter what. And I had a lot of ridiculous ways I tried to manage my alcoholism. Some of them are really silly. One time I purchased a unicycle. I convinced myself that if I just got like a sober activity, I just needed a hobby, right? Because getting a relationship was not something that I was going to be successful at. So the next best thing is obviously like the circus, right? So I got this unicycle with the thought that I would obviously have to stay sober in order to ride the unicycle. And I share that because, like, you know, I don't know how to ride a unicycle today, right? So like my goal when I put alcohol into my system is like the heart and the lungs are working and that's it, right? That's it. My idea of a good time is like lights out, right? I don't want to have like the consciousness of my surrounding. I certainly don't want to experience like the reality of the consequences or the pain of the folks that are around me. So, you know, I had some problems. I had a lot of people tell me I had some problems. The church lady said I had some problems. My mother's a classically trained health professional. She said I had a textbook case of alcoholism. I thought that she was overreacting. I've got this father that doesn't drink and he doesn't do AA, and he gave me this book. The book was called I'll Quit Tomorrow. I thought it was a really catchy title. And none of these things got my attention. And what I was walking through this world thinking is just because I was a jerk, right? It was just because I was a jerk and that I should try harder and I should care a little bit more. And if I could just stay sober until the sun went down, I bet I could do some self-esteemable actions and feel better about myself. So by the time I got loaded and stole your money and did all the things that I did in order to get and stay loaded, I would at least have a shred of dignity to feel better about the lying and the cheating and the gaming I was doing. And so when you think about it, like really, like all I wanted to be was just a little bit more functional. So when I came in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a lot of problems, but I had no idea what my problem was. And what I found inside of AA were people that knew what their problem was. And they went through this book. It was the big book. They gave me a book at my first meeting. The person who would become my sponsor asked me if I had a big book. And I said, no, they gave me a little one because I had a paperback version, right? So, like, that's the personality I bring into, like, Alcoholics Anonymous. It's like, oh, man, like, not even the anonymous people are going to give me the big book. They gave me the little one, right? And so what happens is I go through that book line by line, and I think that, like, there's no mistake in the fact that there's 44 pages of our book dedicated to the first step, which suggests to me that it's pretty important that I understand what I have. And I knew I had problems, and I knew I was a disaster, and I despaired of ever solving them, so what was I supposed to do about it? And so my favorite articulation of what it is that I have is on page 36 with the story of Jim, okay? And it's this beautiful moment because Jim is a guy who had met Bill and Bob before. He got some information about sobriety. He got some information about the steps. He said, thank you. He was a polite guy. He went off and he lived his life. And what he's telling Bill and Bob in this account, starting on page 36, is what happened, right? And so the way it happens for Jim is the way that it happened for me, right? So the first thing is that if I'm running game on you, I'm going to give you way more justifications for my crazy behavior than are necessary. And so Jim tells us a couple of times that he's a car salesman, right? And so the first thing he says is he went into work for a concern he once owned. He says he has a few words with the boss, wasn't anything serious. So he's justifying these resentments, and because he's a car salesman, so he's going to go sell a car, but it's so far away in the country that he's got to stop because he's hungry, right? I can relate to that. Jim's a guy that solves his problems. I understand what this is like. So he stops, like any red-blooded American, at a bar. And he eats a sandwich. I love sandwiches just like Jim. He eats another sandwich. I don't know why he eats two sandwiches. But then what he says in his report, right, is that suddenly he gets this thought, like, suddenly he gets this thought that if he took whiskey on a full stomach, it wouldn't hurt him. And have you ever had the experience of being smack dab in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous trying to explain your thinking, and then once you hear it, you're like, oh my God, I'm doomed. I can't even believe that I believe that. But that's how alcoholism manifests in my brain, is that one side manufactures it and the other side signs off on it like it's absolute fact. I'm acknowledging my time. So there's Jim. I'm Jim, right? So the way it happens for him is he's just struck with this ridiculous thought that milk and whiskey, I can get away with it, right? But you and I both know the reality of that story is that all we needed to know is it was Tuesday, right? It was over for Jim on Tuesday. That's all he had to say. It was Tuesday, Jim. Welcome back, right? And so inside of Alcoholics Anonymous, there were people who could articulate that. I didn't understand that once I put alcohol into my system, there was a phenomenon of craving that was beyond my control. I didn't understand that I was the only kind of person that could tell you when I was thinking about drinking and when I wasn't thinking about drinking. That's what Jim does. He says, I wasn't thinking about it. I wasn't thinking about it. I wasn't thinking about it. I was thinking about it, right? That's what obsession is. I'm insanely, acutely aware of when I'm thinking about booze, right? And so Jim drinks like I drink. Jim just drinks to end the cycle of monotony of alcoholism inside of my brain. And so for me, my story was simple. It was that nothing had ever sandwiched itself in between me thinking about drinking and picking it up until I found Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous was the only thing that could interrupt that process, right? And so I'm excited about AA because there's a solution here. So I'm working steps. I'm writing inventory. I'm writing a lot of inventory, right? I'm writing a lot of inventory in my first steps, right? It was a long one. You know, it was a 9-hour fifth step that I was 45 minutes late to my life and death errand, but I had a lot to say, right? And what happened for me is, like, I was really expecting that the fifth step meant that we were going to have a conversation. We were going to talk about the yeah, but column, right? I really thought that, yes, I was going to admit that I was selfish. I was dishonest. I was full of fear. But yeah, but, right? And what I came to find was something different. And the difference is, like, described for me. It's like there's this spot right before the third step. And it talks about the man who falls victim to the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction in this world if he only manages well. When I write inventory, what I get to find out is the truth about what's my job and what's Creator's job. And after I do that third step and I launch into my fourth step and I tell the truth about things that I've never told the truth, and I begin to see how much those resentments have dominated me, how many moments were stolen away from the obsession I had with how wrong you were. All of my inventory for 12 years can be summed up like this. Courtney thinks there's jerks in the world. Courtney thinks it's her job to inform the jerks that they are jerks, right? It's an exhausting way to live, and I wish it were different. I wish I had something way more beautiful. I wish I had something that wasn't spiritual kindergarten, but that's kind of it. I'd be a spiritual giant if there weren't any people around, right? And so then as I get to like the sixth step, and this is like high stakes poker now, right? Because when I get here, you ask me if I'm willing to go to any lengths. And I know what the right answer is. And I want to believe that I say, yes, I'm willing. But I know kind of I don't necessarily really mean it, right? But I'm hoping I do. But by the time I get to the sixth step and the seventh step, I know it's high stakes poker because I know that that's the same God that's relieved me of the compulsion to drink. And so when we talk about becoming willing to have our Creator remove the defects that they deem removable, not me, that kind of sacrifice, that kind of surrender, I know that God is probably going to deliver on that promise, right? And so the kind of inventory experience that I just described, I didn't have that the first time I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, right? The first time I came into Alcoholics Anonymous was 2 months before my 21st birthday. I did all the things, right? But I started to take my power back in two arenas, and that was, one was time and one was money. I had to catch up. I was certain that I had to catch up, and I had to prove to this world that I wasn't stupid and that I needed to get solid right away. And so I just started taking my power back little by little. And I picked up a drink again that first time after being sober for 3 years for a really simple reason. I desperately wanted to change the way that I felt. Because the way that this manifests in my brain is it's cunning and it's baffling and it's powerful and doesn't look like you should pick up a drink because this isn't working. It looks like I know every single person's secrets in this room of AA and I don't like any of them. It looks like I'm driving down the street and I see a billboard and I see these really happy, beautiful people in this advertisement for a convertible car. And I start looking at these people and I think, man, they're so happy. You know, they're so happy. They're laughing in that way where like their necks are showing, you know? And I start thinking, if I just had a convertible, I bet I'd be okay. But the reality, what really is true about that story is I'm driving down the road and I see that billboard and I tell myself I just needed a convertible and I'd be okay. Is in 3 blocks, swear to God, my hand to God, I realize I'm driving a convertible. It was like a 1989 Rabbit with a drop top, but it was a convertible technically, right? And so these are the things that my mind manufactures. And if I'm not honest and open-minded and willing, I don't have a chance to see them. If I'm not engaged in a relationship with a power greater than me, in which I can see, right, which I can allow for that creator to discipline me, I'm not disciplined. I don't come to this honestly. I don't come to this lightly. I don't come to this because I'm trying to be a good AA member. I come to this because I have to. And I realize that I have to because chances are that I did it pretty wrong for a couple of time spurts. And so that inventory process where I was able to really see just how different it was and just what was at stake in the sixth and seventh step led me into a process of amends in a way in which I'd never experienced. And what that looked like was really simple. It wasn't this baffling experience that was a secret. It looked like I looked at where I had been wrong and I sat across the table from people and I told them exactly what I had done. And then I listened to what they had to say. And there are things that I've done sober that are really bad. There are harms I have done sober that are maybe greater harms than the ones I did drunk. And I occasionally get an idea that I bet I could just knock it off, right? I bet I could just stop my bad behavior without having made an amend, because I don't like making amends. Right. And so I tell myself sometimes, like, I could probably just skip the amend and do better next time. And that's something that I know doesn't work. Right. I cannot stay sober on my good intentions. Right. I cannot stay sober with my can-do attitude. Right. And so as I've stayed sober, there's definitely some things that have happened to me, some things that I didn't want to happen. I was married and divorced as a direct result of my alcoholism at 7 years sober. It wasn't pretty. I had a home group that I wasn't really showing up to in a way that I wasn't really taught to. And I was really trying to manage this relationship. And as I got further and further from that group, I tried harder and harder to just find my part where I was wrong and fix it. Find my part where I was wrong and fix it. And I tell that story not because I wasn't wrong and not because those were errant actions, but because I can't just do a little bit of this program, right? That my sobriety has to have the three legs of the table. And when there is no service part of my recovery, there's a lot that gets lost. And so I have this experience of being so afraid of what's going to happen to me if that relationship ends, because I'm afraid that I'll have to change. If I admit that I have to leave, then I have to change. And if I have to change, I don't know that I'm going to be okay. And I have this experience of sometimes the fears that eat me up inside are the ones that are actually happening. That relationship had been over for a while. And when I jumped right back into the center of Alcoholics Anonymous, I sat in my home group, and it was we were rotating. So there was, we were electing new service positions. And we went around the room, and there was one service position left. And I didn't have one, and I wasn't going to stand for one because I served at the district level, and I was very busy. And that was interesting perspective. And so the last service position is the coffee maker. I don't know what it's like at your group, but the coffee maker's got to get there, like, hours before the meeting. And the vats, those haven't been cleaned since, like, I don't know, Bill, maybe, right? I'm acknowledging the time. And I did not, I was sober for 9 minutes. I did not, or excuse me, that's, I was sober for 9 years. I have 5 minutes. I acknowledge the time twice now. I was sober for 9 years, so I can't make the coffee, right? And so I had this incredible year as the coffee chair at my home group. And what it did was it got me to my meeting early. And it got me to be able to, like, shake hands and be the hand that reaches out to the people that were coming from us from the Salvation Army, to the people who knew nothing about Alcoholics Anonymous. I got to be that face of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I behaved better than I ever would have, right? And that's a big deal, right? And so this experience that I'm having lately is that in August, I'm from Denver. I got sober in Denver, and I had a home group in Denver, the one I just described, and it was pretty important to me. And in August, my wife and I moved here. And so that's not very long. And May of last year, we were married. So my wife and I have a really wonderful story that's about telling the truth, which is about showing up, which is about me telling a lie, about not having done my taxes, and then being honest with her about how I didn't do my taxes. And now my wife, I'll tell you this much, she's a black belt Al-Anon. So she had a few words for someone who doesn't pay their taxes. She thought that the IRS was, like, going to knock on the door, like, tomorrow, you know? And so the reason that I share that is because I was able to be honest in a really unlovely way. Not the first time, but definitely the time that counted. And I was able to say, like, this is who I am, and this is where I've been, and this is what I'm bringing to the relationship. Not in a way of, like, you're not going to want to love me, but in a way of, like, this is the whole package. And we have this experience where we talk a lot about the capacity of being in partnership. And so then we decided we would just move across the country in August into New York, which is a great time to move to New York if you want to grow spiritually. And if you want to spend a lot of time in your apartment in your first year of marriage learning about how to grow spiritually. And so I'll tell you what, there's a lot of days where there's egg on my face. There are a lot less days where there's egg on her face. But God has given us an experience that honestly, I don't want. I don't care for the circumstances that we're having. But here's what I know today, because of the experience that I have, because my day-to-day experience is grounded in this faith and that same power that relieved me of the compulsion to drink, that by the very reason that I don't want this stuff to happen, that it is absolutely happening for a reason. And I'm able to move into acceptance in these small ways, right? In these sometimes just a moment, right? And sometimes that moment is I've never heard a bird chirp so clearly in my whole life. And who would have thought that I would have to move to Brooklyn, New York to listen to birds, right? And so I share that because it's one thing for me to go through my life and acknowledge the presence and the power of God. But I think that what's suggested in our 11th step is something a little bit different. It's not that that's not good. That's great. But I think what's asked of us in our 11th step is that I make the effort, that I stop and I open and I listen and I create that time. Because my relationship, just like with my wife or my sponsees or my friends, it cannot go one way. I am acknowledging the time. It cannot go one way. I have to also reach and I have to also participate. And since that kind of clarity, I've gotten to have, like, a really rich experience in my prayer life, in my meditation, and I'm seeing how slowly these things like intuitive thoughts come into being. I'm seeing how instead of being angry that I didn't pause when agitated or doubtful, that I can come to that awareness, that I can take a pause, that I can take a break, that I can invite God into it, that I can do a 10-step with a fellow. And the last thing that I'll say is that I'm really grateful to this group. There are members of this group who have absolutely been the hand that's reached out when anyone, anywhere. My transition has been made possible because of a lot of members here, and it's been an honor and an absolute privilege to share with you all tonight. And I want to say in advance, happy birthday to the Chip Takers.